This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of New Books Network Podcast. I am your volunteer host, Lee Pierce, rhetorician in upstate New York, and I am so excited today to welcome another rhetorician to the show, kind of a rare treat, Dr. Andre E. Johnson, and his latest book, No Future in This Country, The Prophetic Pessimism of Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, in the Race Rhetoric and Media series at the University of Mississippi Press. No Future in This Country is sort of a sequel to an earlier book that Dr. Johnson wrote about Bishop Turner. And in this case, it's a history of his career, 1834 to 1915, specifically focusing on his work from 1896 to 1915. So this is sort of the second half of his legacy, drawing on the copious amount of material from Turner's speeches, editorials, open and private letters. Dr. Johnson tells a story of how Turner provided rhetorical leadership during a period in which America defaulted on many of the rights and privileges gained for African Americans during Reconstruction. Unlike many of his contemporaries during the period, Turner did not opt to proclaim an optimistic view of race relations. Instead, Johnson argues that Turner adopted a prophetic persona of a pessimistic prophet who not only spoke truth to power, but in doing so, also challenged and pushed African Americans to believe in themselves. So I'm very excited to discuss this book. So Dr. Johnson, are you there? Will you tell the people a little bit more about yourself and about how the book came to be, some of its major themes, and your very longstanding relationship with Bishop Turner at this point?
Well, first of all, Lee, thank you for having me on, and thank you for engaging my work and sharing my work with your superb audience, and just, you know, sharing this work. And it's something that I have been studying and researching. I've been with Bishop Turner since 2005. So started in grad school, my dissertation, The Prophetic Oratory of Henry McNeil Turner, when I finished in 2008. And I love to tell this story about how I found Turner, or, you know, and basically, I'm going to give you the shortened version of it. I knew maybe in my second year of grad school, PhD studies, I wanted to study prophetic rhetoric. I wanted to study prophetic discourse. But one of my committee members at the time and mentors, John Campbell, suggested that I, you know, find me a figure, he said. He said, find you a figure, right, to attach whatever you find on prophetic rhetoric to. It would make for an interesting study, you know, not just in theory, but now you have a real life living figure that you can study. And I said, oh, okay, that sounds good. And the first one, of course, came to mind was Martin Luther King Jr. But I said, well, you know, enough books about him and people are writing more books. Matter of fact, one of my cohort, Frank Anthony Thomas, wrote his dissertation on MLK, examining the speeches of his last year of his life. So King was, and then I just kept looking. I kept looking around and just, oh, okay, having that in the back of my mind. And then I finally came on just a Google search, just was playing around on the computer, just, you know, I don't know. I don't even remember what I was doing exactly, probably just surfing. And I ran across this speech by Turner, 1868. I claimed the rights of a man. A lot of people titled it, but it was on the eligibility of colored members to seats in the Georgia legislature, September 3rd, 1868. Had never heard of this Henry McNeil Turner before, so I began to read the snippets and I was hooked. I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is an awesome speech. This is the speech that it was all prophetic. It was just, I was like, what? How come I have not heard about this speech? This is an awesome speech. And so I began to start looking for research on Turner and like, who is this guy? Learned that he was an AME bishop and, you know, learned a little bit about his history. But I did not see a whole lot of stuff about his rhetoric. So I'm like, oh, okay. Well, maybe 19th century preacher. Spoke extemporaneous, no writings, no kind of, you know, material for me outside of this little speech that I found. Let me dig a little bit deeper in that. Maybe if I can find two or three more examples, maybe I have enough for a dissertation. Maybe this will be my figure because I'm like, I can introduce this figure to the field. Yay. And, you know, and lo and behold, when I just dug just a little bit deeper, I started finding Turner everywhere. I'm like, wait a minute. He wrote over here. He wrote there. He had a weekly column in the Christian Recorder newspaper. And then I really started doing some footnote chasing on books and people mentioned Turner. And I went and tried to find that material. And I'm like, oh my God, this man wrote extensively. I got all this stuff. Now my major concern is I can't use all this stuff. I need to select which speeches I really want to examine. So basically, that's what happened. That's how I discovered Turner. And the dissertation, which was the first book, The Forgotten Prophet, Bishop Henry McNeil Turner and the African-American Prophetic Tradition, looked at four different speeches and the four different personas that I talk about in the book and the dissertation, and then how he moved from what I am calling an optimistic prophet, where, you know, we're going to all work together, let bygones be bygones, to 1895 when he's, you know, said that hell is an improvement as far as Negroes is concerned. And so the study in the first book was, how do you get from this optimistic prophet to a pessimistic one? And so the rhetorical trajectory with that. The book that we're talking about now picks up on that prophetic pessimism. I always knew that I had a second book in Turner, maybe even a third, but I knew I had a second book because I stopped at 1895 with The Forgotten Prophet. And for the last 20 years of his life, and maybe a little bit longer, but definitely the last 20 years, because we got that line of demarcation after 1895, Frederick Douglass died in 1895, and then you get Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896. So that, I argue, is the impetus for this prophetic pessimism. So for the last 20 years of his life, I argue that he is a prophetic pessimist. And so the book No Future t- talks about how does one find space and place to articulate a vision, to be a prophet to a bunch of folk who looked at Turner as a prophet, a person that is preaching at this time and teaching and orating about immigration, like leaving America, like there is no future in this country for you. A person that is critiquing and slamming, and you're talking about shade. Oh my God, I wish we had time to really talk about some of that shade. The shade that he throws at people, both black and white, just like, you know, he gives as good as he gets, and he comes back at you. You know, reading those debates was just exciting. I wish I could have really spent more time digging into that. But how does a person like that still maintains an audience, still remains in the church? He's a senior bishop of the AME church at this time. And I think, you know, when we think about figures like Turner, and especially institutionalists like Turner, who remain in the church, how does he stay in the church and navigate all of that? Because he is slamming fellow bishops, you know, with their positions. So the question becomes, how does he do all of that and still maintain a place, which I place him in, a place of an African-American oratory, and keeps all of that together? And that's what the book is about. The book is really about, it's six chapters talking about the different contexts and times of his life, the major things that were happening and his responses to them. Also, I try to include the responses of other African Americans as well, especially ones that he disagreed with, so we can have a understanding of the tradition a little bit better, that everybody didn't agree with Plessy v. Ferguson or the war, the Spanish-American War, or even the election of 1900, definitely not immigration. And the last chapter, when he talks about the flag as a dirty and contemptible rag going into the 20th century, that was just not a good thing, a lot of people thought. Very interesting story. I talk about the time that he almost was brought up on treason charges for talking about the flag. And it was Booker T. Washington, his frenemy at the time. I like to call him that because they were good friends, but they used to go at each other all the time as well, too. Because, as you know, Booker T. Washington was more of a conciliatory figure, wanting to work and trying to find a space and a place within the system. And Turner was like, none of that is going to work. we need to reclaim our own agency and do the things that we need to do. And so that's the book. And it was a joy to research. It was a joy to write. And I don't know, maybe a third book is coming. Maybe I'll be back in a couple of years. Who knows?
Yeah, I love a book about the debates.
Right.
Yeah, I felt that too. I was like, oh, I want this whole debate, the play-by-play. Well, and so you raised a couple of, I think, keywords, so to speak, for the book that would be good to unpack a little bit before we dig into, you know, his actual oratory. So you mentioned a sort of prophetic pessimism, which there's a lot of rhetorical traditions that come to a head in this book, which is part of what makes it such a great read. I mean, so often, not to throw shade at my fellow writer, but you read, you know, it's like, oh, here's a bunch of examples of this one kind of rhetoric. And in here, it's very much, we have to almost make a new category for Turner, because he's a little bit of some stuff, but not everything. So maybe we could let people know how you define the genre of that. And then also like how it's specifically an African-American pessimistic rhetoric, and how it's maybe not exactly the same as Afro-pessimism, which is a term that some of the folks might have heard. And then you mentioned Plessy v. Ferguson, which really seems to be the turning point, but I'm not 100% sure that everybody knows what that is. So maybe we could kind of start there and then move into some of the chapters.
Yeah, sure. Not a problem at all. And I am now reshaping re-examining my notion of prophetic pessimism, because I have been asked this a lot, and to kind of unpack it even more. So this is very helpful to me. So, well, good. The prophetic, one of the things, let's just talk about prophetic rhetoric first, and then I bring it to the African-American prophetic tradition. When I began to start studying prophetic rhetoric in our fields of study, basically what prophetic rhetoric looked like was, quite frankly, a Western European understanding of prophetic discourse. And what we mean by that is, Darcy, when I was in grad school, Darcy's book, James Darcy's Radical and Prophetic Tradition in America, book was out, and it was like the main book that talked about the radical and prophetic tradition. And others who wrote articles used that as a foundation or a springboard to kind of examine rhetoric and prophetic rhetoric. And, you know, I have a seminary background, so I really wanted to move away from a religious, biblical understanding of prophetic rhetoric, and I wanted to stay within the oratorical tradition, because I think there are two separate things. I think the biblical prophets are definitely doing something totally different than orators of the 19th or even 20th century, and even today, are doing. So I wanted to make sure that I had that separation, so I just stayed within this oratorical tradition within our field of communication studies, rhetorical studies, so on and so forth. So what I began to understand is that, first, there was really no definition, a working definition of prophetic rhetoric. So I tackled that in my first book, and came up with this working definition, which explicated in the definition, I didn't even know this until I wrote it down and started looking at it again when I was playing around with it, a four-part rhetorical structure. Mm. So this four-part rhetorical structure embedded in this definition could actually be used, and this is the argument I made in the dissertation and in the first book, could be actually used to see if a text prophesied, or if a text itself could be considered a piece of prophetic rhetoric, grounded in the sacred, the sharing of the real situation, a critique of judgment, and offering hope at the end. Those are the four kind of broad tenets, and I go into them, each one a little bit in the first book. But what I also discovered is that most scholars looked at prophetic rhetoric only in two ways, apocalyptic or gerrymandering. The apocalyptic rhetoric, you know, hey, the world is coming to an end and there's nothing we can do. The remnant will survive. And a person saying that, you just need to be a part of the remnant. Or the gerrymandering, calling back the people to a covenant. The reason why all this bad thing is happening to us is because we got away from the covenant. And if you would just come back and do the covenant and be the covenant and do it better, everything would be all right, you know. So I'm looking at that, and I'm reading Turner, I'm reading Douglas, Ida B. Wells, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, Anna June Cooper. I'm reading Black folk, and I'm reading 19th, early 20th century, and then late 20th century oratory. I'm like, wait a minute. I think that there is something else going on. I go back to my definition. I say, okay, my definition is this. This speech looks like a piece of prophetic rhetoric, but it's not an apocalyptic speech. It's not a gerrymandering. They're not calling people back. Matter of fact, for a lot of Black orators, the covenant is the problem.
Right.
No, we need to reshape the covenant. That was Douglass's critique, you know, even though he did a lot of gerrymandering, but as time went on, especially during Reconstruction, he began to re-examine that covenant. He never really left it like Turner. That was the big difference between he and Turner. Turner is like, the covenant doesn't work because America would never treat Black people Right. So you can never appeal to that end. You can't appeal to that any longer. So I said, well, what's going on? Well, these other types of prophetic rhetoric pops up. Optimistic, let's say it is like this notion of celebratory prophecy. Let me just start there. Celebratory prophecy, the prophetic disputation, the mission-oriented prophecy, and then lastly, of course, is what the book is about, the pessimistic prophecy or prophetic pessimism. Because at some time, and this is also, Lee, let me just say this. This is also a trajectory that many folk who adopt prophetic personas, and let me be clear, I'm always saying that a person is adopting a prophetic persona instead of being a prophet, because only people can, the people that follow you deem you prophet. I mean, so you can be a prophet for some people and not a prophet for others, but anyone can adopt a prophetic persona as a rhetorical strategy, if you will. So when these people adopt these prophetic personas, especially in the Black prophetic tradition, you see an arc coming from celebratory or a universal type of prophet to a pessimistic one. And so in the end, some of these same people who were just hopeful and optimistic end up on the pessimistic side. King does, Du Bois does, Richard Allen does, of course, Turner, and maybe a host of other, these are the people that I have kind of looked at and not really written on like that, but just beginning to understand this. So pessimistic prophecy is the, or prophetic pessimism is this whole idea that I have tried everything that I could, persuasion, more suasion, everything, and nothing is happening. And so the pessimistic prophet says, I don't expect anything to take place, to change, to make our lives better in the immediate future. However, I am still called to speak. I'm still called to address these issues. So it goes beyond persuasion to what I talk about in the book, bearing witness, that the prophet is now speaking up for the people that the prophet claims to represent and bearing witness. There's no persuasion. Matter of fact, the reason why I can't even persuade is because in a pessimistic prophetic persona, I am critiquing the very same people who at the same time I am asking or charging that should help us or should do the things that I'm calling them to do. Mm-hmm. So I just pulled a quote from the book. I talk about, for many Black orators, finding the racism to entrench and the American covenant ideals not realistic for Black Americans to attain. They become wailing and moaning prophets within what I call the lament tradition of prophecy. And that is what prophetic pessimism is housed in, the lament tradition. In this tradition, the prophet's primary function is to speak out on behalf of others, to chronicle their pain and suffering as well as her or his own. By speaking, the prophet offers hope and encouragement to others by acknowledging their sufferings and letting them know that they are not alone. In other words, the prophet is speaking what the people are feeling, and it's therapeutic for the people. And that's where the hope is. It's therapeutic for the people because, hey, I'm not alone in this. I'm not out of my mind. Somebody else is feeling like me. This is great. I think I can, make it a little bit. I can go on a little bit knowing that I am not losing my mind, that this is real, that's happening to me. And so the prophet then helps the people develop and reclaim. And this is what I talk about in the book as well, too, in the last chapter, that the prophet helps help the people reclaim their own agency to do the things that they are called to do. So when I talk about his immigration stance, for instance, he wanted Black people to go to Africa. Well, black people did not go to Africa in the numbers that he would have liked in order to do the things that he wanted to do once in Africa. However, two things. One, he did get a good number of people to go. But secondly, and more importantly, what he did in the South especially was to help people understand that there is a way that you can reclaim your own agency by doing the things, again, that you feel called to do. You do not have to sit in this. And what I'm talking about is that black folk probably couldn't go to Africa. Whole lot of money, ships involved. But they sure did leave the South. They went as far as their money took them. And so the point that I want to make, I hope I made in the book, is that Turner's rhetoric is emancipatory and liberating because he opens up a window for African-Americans and the people he claimed to represent he opens up that window for them to begin to imagine that life could be better if they just would just pick up and go and nonviolently, by the way, just get up and leave. We talk about it now in social justice circles as, you know, not submitting to your own oppression, where you can reclaim your own agency and get up and move. Now, you know, some places folk went, it wasn't as good as the South or whatever the case may be. But what Turner was trying to get folks to do and to see was that, yes, we can do this. Because the belief was that black folk could not even imagine doing anything like that, like going to Africa or relocating or doing things that would help them and their family and not having to depend on white people for any type of support or anything. And Turner is like, you can do this. You do not have to be like you are. And he was part of the prophetic tradition, is this whole notion of challenging the people to look to themselves and in themselves to do the things that they are called to do, and believing not only in a creator God, but also in yourself, that same spirit is working in you. So prophetic pessimism is this whole notion of speaking truth to power, claiming, not claiming, that everything is going to be all right and everything is going to be fine, but understanding that what I'm about to say, nothing is going to change in our situation. But I want you to know that I hear you and you are being heard, and I am chronicling these pains and suffering and bearing witness. That's why we like to go back and look at those type of speeches, like the voice crying in the wilderness type of speeches, and we just celebrate them, because those are the ones that were still speaking in spite of. And what I talk about in the book is different from nihilism. Turner never quit. Turner never goes to Africa himself. He never tried to escape. He stays in the South, in Atlanta, doing all of this, taking all of the indignities that everybody else took, and was, because he was part of the people. And that's another thing that I hope, idea that I hope I have began to start changing or bust wide open, is this whole notion of the prophet being this sole, solitary, lone figure that goes up on top of the mountain by him or herself and then come down and pronounce stuff to the people. No, prophets come from the people. And this whole notion of listening to the people encourages and strengthens the prophet and leads the prophet to say what the prophet needs to say, because the prophet is associated with the people, knows the people, because the prophet is part of the people. And the critiques from the prophet are also critiques of the prophet himself or herself, because they are part of the community as well.
Yeah, I mean, no, it comes across incredibly well in the book how embedded, and it tracks with a lot. And also, I should say too, looking back on this 100 years later, he was very right. Because if we look at what's happening right now in Georgia, you can't not Georgia. Read this and go, yeah, he's totally right. It has not gotten better. And so, right, then what is his value if not optimism? And what's interesting about this book is I don't think that a lot of times we think about rhetoric as having value unless it's effective or whatever. And in this case, there was nothing to affect. He couldn't, right? So, I mean, I really liked the reframing of the book. I thought it was very well argued and fascinating. And I mean, you really come away with him. Maybe it's only because you needed to do the work, but it's really shocking that he hasn't made a bigger splash as an orator.
No, Lee, you just hit the nail on the head, I think. You had nothing to affect. I like that because that is it. When you are in, when a prophet adopts his prophetic persona, the prophet is discerning that, you know, it is so broken. This context, this world even, is so broken that nothing in the immediate is going to change. But do we quit? Do we give up? Do we not get up in the morning? No, we still get up, and I am called to say these things out and say these things out loud. And he was doing this all the way up to his death, May 8, 1915. I mean, Turner was the I told you, I almost the title of this book, the I told you so prophet, because each and every time something major, I mean, you know, something happens, right? You know, Plessy v. Ferguson, Turner was talking about the Supreme Court in 1883. Plessy v. Ferguson is 1896, where separate but equal becomes the law of the land. And Turner is noticing this happening in state after state, because he traveled extensively, that people and the state lawmakers were making laws that invoked the spirit, if not the perfect ideal of Plessy v. Ferguson, or separate but equal. And so in 1883, when the Supreme Court struck down the civil rights law, or the Civil Rights Bill, as being unconstitutional, that, you know, one of my favorite phrases in the entire book and in Turner's entire lexicon, when he called the Supreme Court an abomination of Negro-hating demons. An abominable conclave of Negro-hating demons. Mm-hmm. And so the point that Turner was making there, now, not winning any friends by critiquing the Supreme Court like that, but he is bringing to bear, and I talk about the agitative rhetoric that is part of the prophetic tradition, going back to the 8th century prophets in the Bible, but he's trying to bring attention to the fact that this stuff is happening whether we want to believe it or not. And there were a lot of Black people, believe it or not, that did not see that. They were more conciliatory, trying to, okay, we can work this out, you know. I have a good friend who's telling me that they're not going to go, you know, only go so far. But Turner is not like that. Turner is like, no, this is redoing Reconstruction. It's undoing all of what we fought for in the Civil War. And part of this is Turner's commitment to the Union during the Civil War. First African-American chaplain in the armed forces. He fought for freedom with his, what he called his troops in the first United States colored troops. I mean, he is as American can be, right? He's doing this and he's believing in this wholeheartedly. Reconstruction comes. He believes in this. He wants to work in Reconstruction, becomes a politician in Georgia during Reconstruction. He wants to work this thing out. He wants to be conciliatory himself, but he begins to understand and believes that there is no reciprocation on the other end. And all conservatives wanted to do at that time was to crush the Reconstruction and to try to get back to the way it was. And Turner was one of the ones early ones to see that and just to call it out. And so that's why he moves to this pessimistic stage, because he has this, he has history on his side. He's looking back and he's saying, you know, I tried to be conciliatory and I tried to do this. And, you know, we passed the 15 amendment. I gave a wonderful speech with the 15 about the 15th amendment and its passing. It was a beautiful speech, a good, I mean, people who love America will just love this speech, because it's just a nice 1870, just this love of country, and this country is better now, and we're going to do right, and we're going to be right. Yeah, that lasted maybe a week or two.
Yeah. So
Turner gets to this point, and yeah, he's not, you know, I think I talked about in the last chapter when I said what we can learn from Turner is this whole notion of did I mention toxic optimism here? Can't remember now. I know it's in some of my writings. While I talk about this whole, no, I think prophetic pessimism protects us from being from having a toxic optimism. This whole notion, and we can see it today in our politicians. We can see it today where people are still holding out hope for this bipartisan, you know, work and this effort. And if Turner was here today, he would be shaking his head like, why are you doing this? Why are you? don't waste your time. You know, let's plan for that not happening, because there are certain segments of the population that don't want it to happen, and they have the power to not make it happen. So Turner would be that person. And I'm, again, just so happy and glad that I have an opportunity to introduce him to the field. And I hope others, his work is extensive, others can pick up on it and do work on it.
Well, and I think more than that, I mean, the book is really challenging the way that as a field, as a country, because rhetoric is so seeped into the way we think about politics, and the idea that speeches are supposed to make people feel better, right? Because it very much serves anti-Black interests if everything that comes out of everyone's mouth has to make, because, like, of course, look at the double bind. I mean, and I'm not telling you, I'm telling the listener, because you already know. But look at the double bind for who's allowed to make people feel bad in the public discourse, right?
Right.
White men get to make people feel bad. Now more and more white far-right women get to make people feel bad. But you can't get a word out of your mouth as a person of color if you don't have lots of nice things to say.
Mama.
And we root it in this idea that, like, well, rhetoric's supposed to be this, this, and that, and good oratories, la, 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 la. It's like, well, no, because Turner's a fabulous orator, but he's operating under such different expectations about what speech should be doing. And I find it a total shift in how we think about how we're going to evaluate what counts as quality speech. And I really appreciate the work that you did, because it's deep. You know, there's a lot of depth to this book beyond just a rhetorical history of one speaker. I mean, this is a challenge to rhetorical traditions, I think, generally speaking.
Wow. Thank you for that. I don't know. Have I thought about it in that way? This whole challenging the rhetorical tradition. I know I've talked about, you know, that in other settings. I think going back to what you said earlier about the expectation of speeches and how speeches should make us feel and stuff. And this is the point I wanted to make in the book as well, too. That Turner's speeches did make certain groups of people feel real good.
That is true.
Like, yeah, go Turner. You know, I mean, even when he dies, you know, as a controversial figure, 25,000 people showed up at his funeral. I mean, he was so well known, and beloved, especially from African Americans in the South. The sharecropping class, poor African Americans, people who were in prison. He spoke up a lot for imprisoned folk. I mean, I don't even touch that in the book, but he did a lot of that work, even to the point of asking the state to have chaplains in the prison. So he's one of the first ones I've read that talked about chaplains in prisons. And of course, that drawing on his chaplaincy work with the armed forces. But Turner is producing a rhetoric, and I think you're right. He is challenging. He's definitely challenging the rhetorical histories that we have constructed in late 19th century African-American rhetoric, and maybe even American rhetoric proper, that late 19th century was a Du Bois Washington affair. Like, those were the two major figures that were going, either you were Washingtonian or you were Du Boisian. And here's Turner like, no, I have a third way. I have the, I know Du Bois, we can't integrate because literally he was like white people would not accept it. And we can never get social equality, we can't get really any inequality. You can't go into a restaurant other than if you are a servant or nursing a baby. There is no integration for you. And then, of course, Washington, if we just submit and not vote and not do these things that, you know, human beings like to do and need to do, and we can't stand up for ourselves because we'll be afraid to get knocked down, then we will pass that on down to our children ad infinitum. And that's not a way to live. So what is the third way? The third way is this nonviolent approach of not sitting in your oppression, not supporting the oppression. Let's just get up and move. So when people ask me, you know, in classes or in groups, like, you know, he was just being unrealistic, and, you know, and maybe he was, because, you know, a whole lot of money it took to get to Africa. But my question would be, how would America look if 1 million African Americans did leave in late 19th century, left the South, just left? How would
And I think there's an argument to be made for Africa as a metaphor here too. Okay. Like he probably meant it literally, but you see this echo throughout the, which is a kind of a point you come to in the conclusion when you say he sort of kicked off the Black radical tradition, that you can rhetorically leave ideological oppression. I mean, right. It's a different way of thinking about it, but there's still a way to reclaim that, even if, you're not physically going to.
Exactly. So even the physical move, like a person leaving Memphis to go to Chicago, for instance, in the Great Migration 1, Great Migration 2, or Chicago to Detroit, or wherever. And then this whole notion of this emancipatory liberation, or thinking that, you know, I am not going to be beholden to this idea any longer. I am going to reclaim my rhetorical agency, and I'm going to do the things that I need to do. So I ask those questions. I say, you know, how would Africa be? What would the difference be? And why did white landowners fight so vigorously to pass laws to trap, and I use the word trap, to trap African Americans to continue working on their lands for little or no money? Why did they do that? Because they understood that if that would have happened, that the economic structure would have been totally different. You know, we began to understand about these massacres that have happened, Reconstruction on up, by looking at Tulsa last week, commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa massacre. And people began, for the first time, that I have on social media and other places, began to ask those questions. Wait a minute. What happened to all of the property? And what about this whole notion of transfer of property, this inherited property, and the jobs that were lost? You know, the people that were working, who were getting a wage each and every week or 2 weeks or whatever, and then they lost out. And so Turner is saying, actually, I can make an argument that he's making an economic argument that if we would just not support this any longer by getting up and leaving and going to a place that maybe people would come to the table before we get on those ships, perhaps, and want to talk a little bit about what it could be like. So a difference.
Yeah. Well, and I feel we haven't really given any, you and I are both like good Michael Leffians, right? We love a close reading, and we haven't really gotten a chance to dig into the meat of some of these speeches. So do we want to maybe turn now to actually, because we've done a great job. I mean, you're fabulous at the overview. Is there a particular speech? I mean, you open with this really excellent exchange where Turner says, well, what's to say that America is civilized in the first place? And then you have the editorial where he sort of asks people, black folks to see themselves in God and for white people to see the hubris of assuming. I mean, there's all kinds of, there's the speeches he did for McKinley. So is there one in particular that you like that we want to maybe do a little bit of digging into for the audience?
Let's see here.
I mean, there's so much great close reading.
The notion, I guess, let's just maybe the last chapter. Last, but chapter six, where, hell is an improvement so far as the Negro is concerned. Turner and the damning of America. And so Turner is full-throated now, prophetic pessimist, right? And, in this chapter, I talk about his views on race and how they kind of fluctuated over time. And I want to try to get to the speech that really got him in trouble when he called the flag a contemptible rag. And so, he makes mention that the flag should be spit upon by African-Americans. The flag does not mean anything. And he really got some heat for that. Everybody came out to him about that. White and black press, the black press, here it is, the black owned newspaper, the Atlanta Independent, criticized Turner as well, publishing in the Richmond Times Dispatch. The editors of the Independent wrote, nobody takes Turner seriously. They called Turner a freak and wrote that his words were incendiary, treasonable, sacrilegious. They suggested that Turner's utterances now no more represent the conservatism and representative character of the race in the state than did the convention. And they just went on and just critiqued Turner. Critiqued Turner mightily. And this is the black press. This is folk that he knew and knew well. But they even thought that he went overboard. But of course, Turner, defended himself. And he began to come back. He talked about he was misunderstood, but not in the political way of I was misquoted. He was like, I didn't say this, but I did say this. let me say this. And basically, he was just saying that for black people, the flag does not carry the same meaning that it does for white people in America. That's all. And so, quote, God and nature help those who help themselves. If we had stood up like we should have done, we would not be puppets of degradation. Or if we had manhood and dared to defend our rights, there would be no Jim Crow cars. I would say one more word, and you may infer my meaning. Without the consent of Negro, no cars will run in Georgia. I am sorry to say that they are running by cowardice and disunited action. Mm. There is no harmony among us, no concern about our rights and the rights of our children and our children's children. He suggested that everyone who sits quietly was tying their children's children to the wheels of degradation for 100 years to come. Turner reasoned that such people should not become parents and that African Americans must start to reclaim their own agency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's so much. He moves so swiftly through pessimism and realism and history and prophecy. And I mean, and looking back now, yeah, like I said, I mean, time has clearly vindicated his vision, right? Unfortunately. I mean, it's always weird.
One more quote, if I can. Thinking about Turner reflecting on his past, thinking about race and how wrong he was. And this is the move I tried to make. In the book, each chapter starts off as like a flashback, right? I try to go, like we were watching a movie and we go back in time and we see how Turner gets to this point. You know, mm-hmm. just don't show up pessimistic. It's a process, right? So here's one of the solid quotes that helps the reader understand Turner. Many years ago, I said in my speeches and articles for the public press that as soon as the Negro acquired education and wealth, we would be brought in touch with each other. Talking about white folks. But I have lived to see the day when the Negro graduated from the first colleges of the land, or the finest colleges of the land, abound upon the right and the left, and thousands can count their wealth by hundreds of thousands of dollars. And instead of being looked upon and appreciated by the dominant race of the land as more entitled to a favorable consideration, they are regarded in most instances as more pestiferous and dangerous, and are the victims of more ridicule and contempt. Therefore, the theory is a phantom, and every man with common sense fully realizes it. So this
the theory is a phantom is such a good line.
Right. Yeah, so this notion of uplift, like if you would just work hard, this is Washingtonian, work hard, save your money, thrift, don't worry about politics, don't worry about the public arena, just stay in your own life, like they were doing in Tulsa. Just have your own block. Just stay right there. Don't do any. Have everything you need right there. Don't do anything wrong. And everything will work out and everything would be all right. And that was the theory that Turner called a phantom.
Tulsa only happens, what, a couple years after Turner dies. Right, so, I mean, these are very contemporary. Right. That's what's really terrifying. Yeah.
I was thinking the same. 6 years, right? 1915, mm-hmm. Turner dies, and then Tulsa happens in 1921. So this is six, and up until the, you got 1906, you got the great fire that happened in Atlanta. You got all these other massacres, Wilmington in 1898, the Memphis massacre that I have done some research on in 1866. You got, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. Louisiana, you got other, all over the place. You got all of these, and Turner is responding to the ones, of course, that he could respond to. And he's talking about them and critiquing the policing, the law enforcement, the lawyers, the system in total. I mean, he's like, you know, another quote. Degradation bedets degradation. While respect and honor beget respect and honor, for not more than one man out of every 100,000 rises above his environments, and our degradation in breeding contempt for each other every hour of the day. And it has gone on such an extent that nearly every colored person who can is trying to pass for white, and another portion is buying this deadly hair straightening drug. Talking about hair. And are trying to pass for Indians, Cubans, Mexicans, anything rather than Negro. I have had application from churches as a bishop praying that I would not send them a black pastor. A third of our race today had rather be monstrosities than black gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
This is his note. He is talking about this whole notion of colorism, this notion of lightening, a whitening creams that were being sold, these tonics that were being sold to make your skin a shade or two lighter or whiter, as the advertisement would say. Talking about, you know, good hair, bad hair type of dichotomy, that's going on within the African-American community at the time. And Turner is trying to get people to appreciate the features of their African-Americanness, of their Blackness. And if you can't, his argument, if you can't see yourself as beautiful in and of yourself, then that's an issue. And then in chapter two, I bring up the religion point where he says God is a Negro. And right, the argument is, if you cannot even see, for you who are people of faith, if you cannot see the divine, in your image or looking like you, then there's a problem. You will never be able to get out of believing that white is always right and Black is always wrong. And he's talking, and this is what he's doing in like 1880, 1885, 1890, you know? So, in a lot of ways, he was way ahead of his time, way ahead of his time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of those, I never know how to end these because you want to say how wonderful and interesting the book is, but it's also, it's challenging and upsetting and also in a very productive way. So I never know really the right way to say it, but certainly your presentation of Turner is riveting and interesting and deep, and the way that he creates these threads of Black radical thought that you can now see resonate and all of the people that came after him. I mean, I really enjoyed this book quite a bit. And I will say, I'm not normally like a rhetorical history biography person. So I was a little like, oh no, another, but this is a totally different animal, this book. And I enjoyed it so much. And then of course I went back and read your first one because they're sort of partners. Yay! And so once again, I just want to thank you for the great read. And I'll be coming back to this book a lot, I think, in future years. Do you want to let people know what you're up to, maybe about the hashtag HDM project, which I will link in the show notes if anybody wants to learn more about it.
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Yeah, hi. Anything you want to say for like final thoughts?
Oh, final thoughts. First of all, Lee, thank you for having me on the podcast, and thank you for taking seriously my work and pushing it out there. And hopefully I can... I was telling somebody the other day, hopefully we can bring back the rhetorical history, people. Yeah, you know, do some
rhetorical stuff.
But in all seriousness, thank you again for this. And I am currently working on, matter of fact, a little bit later on today, I have to respond to the editors, the reviewers' revisions or suggestions of revisions. For the speeches of Bishop Turner. So I'm working on that actually today, a little bit later on today. I will be doing that. So hopefully that'll be out sometime next year, if all goes
well. Oh, that's exciting.
So we're going to have a lot of people appreciate the HMT project, the site that's up, that I got some speeches and writings of Turner, and I'm trying to collect all of them and get them up as soon as I can. But there have been some people, especially in history and like African-American history or church history, they really wanted a book or a volume of speeches. So we'll do that so you can have that and begin. Hopefully people can begin to look at those speeches and begin to start analyzing them, doing a close reading and seeing what else is in those speeches. So that's one of the things that I'm doing. And I'm also working, beginning a nice project. I am so excited about this. I'm beginning to, in my African-American public rhetoric and public address class, we are going to begin looking at the Colored Convention Project. We're going to be looking, Dr. Pierre Foreman and her team doing an excellent job there. But one of the things that we want to do is we want to analyze those speeches from the convention and begin a process of not only maybe doing an edited collection of those speeches, but also a book of essays centered on those speeches as well. So, and among the other things that I'm doing. So those are the two main things, dealing with just oratory and public address, that I'm doing, and hopefully When those come out, I can make another appearance and talk about that as well.
Yeah, and if you and your students do the collection of essays, we'll bring you and a couple of them on, and we can do a group chat. Yeah, we do that for edited volumes sometimes. Really? Well, it's been wonderful. Like I said, the book was just absolutely a pleasure to read, and you're incredibly. I'm glad that if I were Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, I would be glad that you were the one to bring me back into rhetorical consciousness. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you.
So once again, to everyone listening, we've been chatting with Dr. Andre Johnson about the book that just came out, 2020, No Future in This Country, The Prophetic Pessimism of Bishop Henry McNeil Turner from University of Mississippi Press. And if you have a chance to pick up the book, please do. But if you're not inclined, maybe this has sated your appetite, a very cool thing for you to do would be to buy a copy of the book and donate it to your local library. There are so many people who are not getting access to this, much of it because of systemic racism, that the people who really need to read this kind of work are the ones that have the least access to it. So donating a copy to a library with a struggling budget is a wonderful thing to do. You can also, if you're on a university campus, request that your campus put a copy of the book on their shelves as well. And we'd just like to thank all of the university presses who help make work like this possible. And so with that, I will tell everyone thank you. Quick little invitation to get vaccinated if you haven't done that yet. And Dr. Johnson, do you want to leave us with any final thoughts?
Thank you again for having me. And I just look forward to whatever is next.
Wonderful. Well, thank everyone. Have a nice summer. We'll talk to you soon.